Southern Baptist Theological Seminary Institute for Christian Worship. Our practice is to bring in scholars, musicians, artists who can articulate the gospel in their idiom. And we're so thrilled to have Kevin Tritt here with us for these several days, along with the band from Nashville, Indelible Grace. And this lecture is part of our class entitled Christian Worship and Contemporary Culture. So we'll turn this over to Kevin at this time.
Good. Christian worship and contemporary culture. All right. Some of you guys were with us in the last hour, and we've kind of worked partway through this, why we still need hymns in a postmodern world. Since this is the Christian culture one, I want to start out actually with a different outline, if I can find it here. And I might have left it back here. Hold on. Do you have one there that talks about some thoughts on understanding postmodernism and why it matters? Yeah, it's green. Okay, great. Good. Since this is contemporary culture, we'll talk a little bit about postmodernism and then get back into the other outline, which we started on in the last hour, with a little catch-up for the people that weren't here in the last hour. Postmodernism. Everybody, you know, it's hard to find people that deny that it is something. It's really hard to find anybody that would say they understand what it is. The best quote I found here is this. Wait, it's on the back. Actually, flip the page over. This guy, I don't even know who this guy is, Ernest Gellner, but I read it in a book. Somebody else was quoting him. He said, "Postmodernism is a contemporary movement. It is strong and fashionable. Over and above this, it's not altogether clear what the devil it is." After reading a bunch of books on this topic and working with college students all the time, that's the best quote I've seen on this. But it is something that we can kind of describe some of the aspects. It's like defining rock and roll. I remember writing in seminary a paper on criteria for judging rock music. And the hardest part is actually defining what rock and roll is. It's pretty easy to recognize when you hear it, but try to actually define it. Very difficult. Aesthetics is a very difficult field to actually describe things philosophically. Anyway, here are some of the things that I think are interesting, and in particular, maybe pathways that connect us to understanding some of this resurgence of interest in hymnody and mystery and worship and wanting to use older liturgical forms, which there really is a renaissance of interest in that sort of thing. Not necessarily the majority of college students, but a significant undercurrent that's all over the place. And there are a lot of evidences for that sort of thing. There's a new book called The New Faithful, Why Young Adults Are Embracing Christian Orthodoxy, written by a Roman Catholic lady named Carol is her last name. Fascinating book, where she argues that the fastest growing church in Wheaton, Illinois is the Greek Orthodox Church across the street from the campus. And why is that? Or, and I think it's either an Episcopal or a Greek Orthodox church up across, what's the big, huge church? Is it here in Louisville? There's a big mega church around here somewhere. Yes, bigger than huge. That's here in Louisville? Yeah, but she at least says that there's maybe another church, Greek Orthodox or Episcopal. Yeah, that's growing like crazy. Most of the people from that church. And I see that even at our church, because we're a church down in Nashville, Christ Community Church, that a lot of baby boomers, a lot, you know, contemporary worship style. In my college Sunday school class, we sing all hymns. Then we go to worship, we sing praise choruses, and my students, after tasting these hymns, have kind of gotten to the point where they turn their nose up at a lot of the praise choruses, regarded as shallow. And it's very interesting. It surprised me about a month ago. Well, maybe it's 2 months ago now. We were doing corporate prayers, and they would flash them up on the screen. We have a PowerPoint kind of set up. And some of my students said, "I don't want to pray something unless I've had a chance to read it beforehand and make sure that I really believe it and own it." I said, "That's interesting." So they're like, "Can you get them please to print those in the bulletin so that we can read them beforehand? Because otherwise, I'm not going to pray." And I've had students walk into our RUF meeting and refuse to sing until they've had a chance to read through the words. Because they want to be authentic, right? It's kind of the buzzword, being authentic. And part of that we really want to value, I think. Now, I think that becomes an idol as well, this idea of authenticity. And I think, of course, the gospel is the only thing that sets us free to be truly authentic. because we don't have to hide anymore if Jesus is our righteousness. But what are some of the aspects we'd say, just briefly, describing postmodernism? Certainly a skepticism about scientific rationalism, renewed interest in spirituality and spiritual things. All you got to do is go to Barnes & Noble, Borders books, and see just a huge section on spirituality that didn't exist 20 years ago. The X-Files, I think, is a great show for understanding sort of the cultural shifts that are going on. If any of you are fans of that show, it started out, it was much more clear in the early days than it became by the end. But there are two FBI agents, one Mulder and one is Scully. And Scully sort of represents the older epistemology, the older way of understanding how do we know what we know. Because that's the great shift that's going on. How do we know what we know? And Scully, for Scully, she's also a medical doctor. It's through, she always wants to do an autopsy. And we'll kind of get to the bottom of what really happened. You know, trust the scientific method, trust, you know, what she can measure and examine. But then you've got Mulder, Fox Mulder, and he pretty much just kind of goes with his gut. And often in the early days of that show, you know, there'd be something that they were trying to investigate, some, you know, strange, mysterious thing. And the show would sort of leave it ambiguous about which explanation really fit. Was it the autopsy? Well, that presents one explanation, but then Fox has this other explanation, and which is true. And that's really part of the shift that's going on in our culture. Do we know things by logical categories and by examining them, or do we sort of just know things by our gut, experientially? Okay. But there, because of this, there's much more openness to spirituality and things that can't be explained scientifically. Scientific rationalism no longer has a corner on the market when it comes to truth and when it comes to ideas. I've talked about this in the last hour. For some of my students, I found about 15, 20 years ago, when I would talk to them about predestination and would try to help them understand the Bible's teaching on that topic by saying something like, you know, in the Bible you have God's sovereignty clearly taught, you have man's responsibility clearly taught. And those things really are in tension. And there are even texts in the Bible that both of those ideas appear in the same verse. There's a real tension and a mystery there. And we need to, if we're going to be biblical, hold on to that tension, that mystery, and not resolve it logically either through Arminianism or hyper-Calvinism. Ask me afterwards if you want to know more about that. Okay. And they would say, you know, it's a mystery. They weren't satisfied with that. They want to say, no, it's got to be either God's sovereign or man's free. Which is it? And now to explain it that in the same way, to students today, they're very satisfied, generally, with the idea that it's a tension and a mystery. And that reflects a changing culture. People are more open to mystery and things that they can't quite figure out. They care more about aesthetics and gut feel. And they're not as so happy with buildings that may be really functional but are ugly. There's a strong hunger for experience, even more than important than fame and money. It blew me away a few years ago talking with a student who, like, I work with students, probably half of them are music or music business majors, and they, you know, they all want record deals. But I remember talking to this one guy, he's like, no, I don't. Our band doesn't want a record deal. That would ruin us. And I was like, what? No, we wouldn't be authentic. We wouldn't be, you know, this band. And I was like, it just kind of blew me away. And I said, okay, something's changing in the air. Because, you know, fame and importance, they actually don't want that. I was like, everybody I know, you know, picked up guitar to meet girls, you know. And I remember when I was in high school, I know that seems silly to say, right? You know, okay, good. I got one testimony. I remember reading Guitar Player magazine in high school, and every guitar hero, that was their testimony, okay? And these guys are like, no, we don't want anybody to know us. We want to have like 20 people that really like us, but we don't want anybody else to even know who we are. And I was like, okay. Certainly a strong theme is a distaste for anything perceived to be plastic or mass-produced, and a strong desire to find things that are authentic. Have any of you guys read this book, Bobos in Paradise? This would be a great textbook for a class like this. Bobos in Paradise, David Brooks, he writes for Atlantic Monthly, a column. Not a Christian as far as I know, but Bobo stands for Bourgeois Bohemians. And this is a book about what he says are the new ruling class in America, people who have taken the 60s counterculture values and connected them or managed to reconcile them with the 90s and the 80s materialism. So people that are pulling down six-figure income but don't feel guilty about it because they surround themselves with things like distressed furniture and the artifacts of oppressed cultures, and that they feel more in touch with, you know, authentic things. Like they feel, it's very interesting. Yeah. Why do people want distressed, beat up furniture? Because it seems to have a story to it. And it seems to be different. It's very interesting. And it's a very funny book, too, I got to tell you. Especially his chapter, for instance, on spending habits and what's appropriate and what's not. It's very, you know, it's considered very inappropriate to spend, you know, $50,000, $60,000 on a Corvette. But you can buy a Hummer because it's a tool. And it's about safety. And so it's appropriate to splurge on that kind of thing. In the 50s, if you look at, like, you know, Good Housekeeping, those kinds of magazines, women were never seen in the kitchen. The kitchen was considered where the servants work. And if you were any self-respecting woman, you didn't want to be seen there. But now in the 90s, of course, if you ever try to buy or sell a house, you realize if you don't have a humongous kitchen that is the center of the household activity, you're going to have a hard time selling your house. Things have changed. And this is the explanation, for instance, of Starbucks. They don't sell coffee, really. They sell a vibe and an aesthetic. McDonald's actually spends more on coffee beans than Starbucks every year. Restoration Hardware. What's going on with there? Why are these companies? Why are so many people drawn to these sorts of things? Very interesting, talking about authenticity and our striving for it. The whole Oh Brother phenomenon. Because I live down in Nashville, and the country music industry didn't know what to do with that record. It doesn't make any sense according to what they think people want to hear, which is basically kind of warmed over pop music from the 70s and 80s now is country music, okay? So it's on country hit radio. But then this record comes out and sells, what, 6-7 million copies? Because it speaks to people about a day and an age that they in some way romanticized probably, but when people were authentic and they were connected to the ground and life and real things and real struggles, and they knew something about that. And people are so drawn to this kind of music. Well, see, I find, you know, I say, gosh, why don't you read the hymns of Ann Steele? She's somebody who understands those sorts of things. The church has always been about, or at least if it's faithful to the gospel, has been about the faith embodied in the midst of a broken world, right in the midst of a fallen world. So there's a real distaste for plastic mass culture, a renewed quest for authenticity, the adoption of cynicism, some of these other things, the attraction of story and stories. I mean, if you have cable TV, you know, you have the Biography Network, and even MTV and VH1 have really become, in a sense, Biography Networks, the Storyteller, and all these shows about behind the music, and people just are fascinated with stories. Again, 20, 25 years ago, that was not the context people really thought about. And it's forcing a lot of Christians to even rethink the way we understand the gospel and articulate the gospel. I think actually in a way that's more faithful to Scripture. So I think that's a really good thing to think in terms of the story and the aspect of the gospel as the greatest story. And again, one of the things that I think is so wonderful about these hymns is you get invited into a hymn writer's story. I think it's so helpful. One of the things I find that really helps younger people connect with the hymns is if they know the story of the hymn writer's life. And almost every one of them, there's some just tremendous suffering. And these students, see, are so desperate to know that Christian faith really does make a difference in the practical world. Not that it tells you, you know, 10 easy steps how to have a great marriage. That's what their parents want to hear. These students want to know that the faith is something that can be depended upon. Not that it makes everything easy, but God is going to walk through the flames and the water with me, like Isaiah 43 says. And so the attraction of story and stories. See, the church, here's what I'm saying. We don't have to sort of try and jump on the bandwagon and say, oh, okay, gosh, we got to find something. We already have the story. And we already have all these wonderful stories of those who have went before us, have tasted even in the midst of tremendous suffering, and have written about it in the most wonderfully rich, passionate, moving language for all of us to sort of try on. Tim Keller, pastor at Redeemer Presbyterian Church, says that postmodern people, rather than just being convinced by you laying out a bunch of evidences, they actually want to try on a worldview and see how it fits. And so, actually, in our worship music, we have an opportunity for non-Christians even to try on Christianity and say, oh, this is how a Christian thinks and this is how a Christian feels. huh. You see, we have that opportunity. We don't have to soft sell the gospel to them. They're not really very interested in us doing that. I had opportunity this past semester to do the deacon and elder training in our church. In the Presbyterian church, we have deacons and elders. And though there's no necessarily biblical reason why this is so, generally the elders tend to be the older guys. In our context, more baby boomers. And the deacons are more guys in their late 20s, early 30s, okay? And it was fascinating, as we talked about the same doctrinal issues, taking these guys to the Westminster Confession of Faith, the elders, candidates, generally wanted to know, okay, just give me the bottom line. What is this about? How is this practical? Okay, cool, I'll believe it. The deacon candidates so much wanted to wrestle with this, wanted to say, okay, give me the whole deal. I really want to know the whole thing that we believe, and I want to get into it, and I want to wrestle with it. Don't hold anything back. Now, the reason that's fascinating is because it's generally the elder candidates that are the ones who are supposed to be more interested in theology. Not that either of them, you know, they both need it. But I really saw it as a generational difference. That there's a sense in which we don't want something soft-selled to us. We want to know what we're being invited into. And that has huge implications for what we consider seeker-sensitive worship. Because do we invite people into a worship experience that is only part of the Christian life? That only celebrates certain emotional expressions, but not others? And if so, how are we ever going to get them to sort of kind of step it up and embrace the full nature of Christian experience? And that's, of course, been the great difficulty in seeker service churches, is getting people to leave the seeker service and go to the one that's for mature people. But some of the people I've been reading lately have gotten me really to rethink the whole idea and say maybe we actually need to be singing songs and doing worship that is already about maturity, but certainly explaining it to people. I like Tim Keller uses the phrase, exegeting the worship service. And I've always been thinking in terms, ever since seminary, about exegeting a passage of Scripture. And since I've been in the pastorate, I think more and more about exegeting the people I'm trying to preach to. But now I think in terms of exegeting the worship service, explaining for people, oh, this is a baptism. This is why we do it. This is a call to worship. Why do we do a call to worship? So keeping those elements, but explaining it to people, because they want to know why we do that stuff. They want to be connected to those traditions, but they don't want them just to be empty traditions. They want to understand what it is. Let's see. A couple other things. An intense desire for community, though the tension of that, of course, is not wanting to give up individualism. And of course, there's a great rub in our culture, a great tension produced by that, because the only way to have real community is to give up individual freedom, whether it's marriage, friendship, small group Bible study. You have to give up some of your autonomy if you want to be in a relationship with anybody. And people are just really torn because they've embraced the idea that autonomy and personal freedom is the ultimate, you know, thing to live for, but they have such a longing for community, and they don't see how those two things just, you know, are, you know, knocking heads together. But again, in the hymns and in the worship, we invite people into a community story. We invite people to say, you know, the body of Christ, you know, suffers when one member suffers. I used this illustration in the last hour, but I'll bring it up for those who weren't here. Marva Dawn, whose books I really commend to you, even though, as you'll see in tomorrow's lecture, I have some things I disagree with her about musical style, but just so much she writes is just gold. And she, on a tape I heard, tells a story about talking with a pastor. And they were talking about the worship songs and the kind of music they did at their church. And she asked him how many people in your church had suffered some major life trauma in the last couple of years. And he thought about it. And he said almost every family. And then she asked him to think back over the music that they'd used during those last couple of years. And did those people, you know, basically somebody almost every week they had somebody whose life was falling apart. And were they able to actually work through that before God in the context of a worship service? And sometimes we're just not willing to let people do that. And yet, if we go back to the Psalms for our sort of some guidance in this matter, there are more Psalms about finding difficulty in trusting God and sorrow and suffering and oppression than there are happy Psalms. And there are even Psalms like Psalm 88 that end, "Darkness is my closest friend." And when was the last time we sang that in church? Dan Allender, a great Christian counselor, said if we sang the Psalms more, we'd have a whole lot less need of Christian counselors. And I think the same is true of hymns. Because, you know, the good hymns really mimic the Psalms in this regard. That they take you on a journey. You get to sort of, you know, be guided by somebody who's lived before and went before us in how we wrestle with the gospel and our experience and suffering. Because so many of them were born out of tremendous suffering and were written, you know, even for people suffering. See, what else? I don't want to talk about all these things. I don't want to get back to this other page. There's definitely a law, the consumer culture. We live in a consumer culture which preaches a gospel to us all the time, which is this. You are what you consume. You are what you buy. And if you're one who's come to embrace, you know, the doctrines of grace, predestination, those sorts of things, you may not realize this, but most of the objections you're going to find to talking to people about that, I don't think are so much theological, because most people don't really understand theology. They're just theological parakeets. They repeat what they've heard. They've never really thought about it. They don't really have a very, you know, kind of organic understanding of the way Scripture relates to itself. But they have been preached, you know, what are estimates, you know, 30, 40, 50,000 times by the time they reach 18. They've heard this message from the consumer culture that you are what you buy, and that you choose what you choose to purchase is really what defines who you are. So imagine trying to convince people that God's choice defines them, when everything the culture says to them is their choice defines them. And it certainly fits with the heart and the sinful heart to think that it's our choices that really matter. So we have a lot of work to do in trying to get people to understand the gospel and submit to what the gospel says. And worship is, again, one of the most important things that we can do with regard to shaping people. Worship is about having our sanity restored, like I said in chapel. It's about seeing Jesus as beautiful and believable, and about being reoriented to the truth. Paul uses this image in Galatians about when he confronts Peter. He says, I had to, you know, confront him because he was not walking in line with the truth of the gospel. And Tim Keller says, you know, the gospel is, it marks out a way to live. And there are things that are not in line with it. Like believing that God loves you if you, you know, get your act together. That's not in line with the truth of the gospel. The truth of the gospel is God, you know, while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. But that's hard to believe. And so we come together in worship, and we want to make sure that what we're doing, the prayers, the scripture, the singing, the songs, the words, are all contributing to reorienting us around what's true. It's very, very important, I think. One other thing I'll say, this longing to be part of something rooted rather than ephemeral. There really is a renewed interest in liturgy and ritual. And some of it may just be sort of an interest in things that are old because they seem cool and have a certain mystique to them. But again, when we invite people to become Christians, we're inviting them to join in with something that's so much bigger than we are, so much bigger than just individual salvation. We're inviting them to be part of a story that's much bigger. Categories of creation, fall, redemption, glorification. God who, you know, has made all things for himself. Go down to point three on this same little outline, and then we'll jump outlines. Why do we need hymns, then, in a postmodern world? In some ways, you know, to expound upon all these different things, if you think much about hymns, you go, oh, I see why hymns so connect to so many of these themes. I really love what it says in Ecclesiastes, that God has set eternity in the hearts of all men. And I'll say something about this tomorrow, but a lot of times we think that church music should be basically articulate sort of the classicist model of order and perfection and beauty. But there is an appropriateness to church music that sort of helps bring out that aching and brings it even to the surface a little more. That I think that's very appropriate. It's part of what music and art can do. And so, you know, some of these things, that these longings and achings that God has put in the hearts of people, non-Christian people and Christian people alike, God himself, of course, is the what they're really looking for. I tell you, one thing that Tim Keller helped me understand so much, that put together so many things for me, is that we're transformed by gazing upon Jesus and the beauty the paradoxical beauty of the cross, which is the most scandalous picture, but also the most beautiful picture at the same time, that really transforms us. 2 Corinthians 3 talks about how we with unveiled faces gaze upon the Lord's glory, are being transformed, as the King James says, from one degree of glory to another. That there really is value. We become what we worship. Okay? And that God, what He's doing in sanctifying us, again, is restoring our sanity, making Jesus more beautiful and believable. And here's the interesting thing. The Bible's category for understanding the heart of sin is idolatry. And in the New Testament, it comes over and it becomes lust. But it's basically talking about the same idea. This sort of trying to fill yourself up or worship these false gods because you think and somehow they're more beautiful or more reliable or more powerful than God Himself. And so when God wants to attack that, He does generally two things. In the book of Isaiah is a good example. He will pour scorn upon the idols. And Isaiah 44 is so great. The irony there, if the idol worshippers are trying to feed on ashes. And you can't even say this thing in my hand is a lie. And talks about the craftsman who builds this idol and, you know, half of it he uses to cook his food and the other half he bows down and worships and says, "You're my God, save me." Right? Just pours this scorn on how ridiculous, okay? And there's an appropriateness in that. But then also it reveals God reveals Himself, I should say, as the one who is the divine warrior, as the one who will walk with them through the water and through the flames so that they're not swept away, Isaiah 43. And so what God is doing in the gospel to transform us, and I think really sort of pastorally, in a sense, all I really do is help sort of people kind of see the idols that work. See, a lot of people come to you in pastoral counseling saying, here's the thing I really struggle with. But they're usually talking about the sort of external sins. And so you're helping them to see, well, what the Bible says, the reason you sin is because you're a sinner, you're an idolater. Here are these issues, these false gods that you're looking to and you've allied yourself with. But now understand this. This longing you have, for instance, for security, that you're looking to this idol to meet, what's going to set you free is not me telling you that you just need to quit it. And even an accountability group isn't going to really help change your heart. Okay, what's going to change your heart is seeing that what you're longing for and trying to get in this idol, you already have in the gospel. You're longing for security. You're trying to get it from, you know, being a people pleaser. I had a friend of mine one time went to this Christian counselor. He said, you know, my problem is I'm a people pleaser. And the counselor said, let me redefine that word. You seem real comfortable using that phrase. How about we define it for what it really is? You prostitute yourself to everyone around. Oh, you know, that's a problem. Yeah, well, you know, why do you do that? Why do you do that? Well, you know, to tell that person, hey, don't worry about what other people say. That's generally what the secular psychologists say. Just don't worry about what other people think about you. Well, you can't do that. God made you to bask in the approval of somebody else. Him. The way you're going to help somebody like that is to say, you already have approval in the gospel. And beyond what you can even understand. Paul says, you know, his love is better than we can ask, imagine, or, you know. It's unbelievable. Do you understand the approval in the gospel? And as the beauty of that begins to sort of be shed upon your soul, does that have to have power to sort of help you let go of the, you know, in the light of who Jesus is and what you already have in Him? Doesn't it make this thing seem so paltry and pointless? See, I have a 2.5-year-old, and the only way he's going to hand me anything is if I present something more beautiful to him. Right? Now, I could pry it out of his little hands, but that's not the way to change his heart. And it's not the way to get willing compliance. But what God is doing, he's continually pursuing us, not just to save us, but he continually wants us to be more and more dependent upon him, more and more in love with him. He's after our hearts. And he does that by revealing his beauty and his believability. So, he puts all these themes in us, in our culture. Why do we need hymns? Well, for one thing, the church is not a passing fad. It's something solid and rooted. And if we hold on to church music from the past, we help communicate that. We invite people into a body of believers, a church. We don't invite them just to have a personal relationship with Jesus. We invite them to become part of His body and His kingdom that is on the move, which has been going on for a long time. And if they would rightly understand what they're being brought into, there's lots of ways to communicate that. We want to make sure that we don't communicate that what you're being brought into is just a passing fad. And that's the danger of sort of over-adapting to what the culture really wants and saying, I'm only going to try to do what the culture already thinks it wants. We have to invite people to something that's actually good for them that they may not actually have a taste for yet. That's part of what discipleship is about, right? Even our sense of what's beautiful and what's lovely and what's valuable grows. It's sanctification. Sanctification involves those sorts of things, right? The arts, stories, poetry, music, all combined to sneak into the heart by the back door. And that's something increasingly important for our ministry of the coming generations. Kevin Ford, in a typical book about reaching postmodern people, says this: how will you reach this postmodern generation, a generation that cannot conceive of objective truth, cannot follow your linear arguments, cannot tolerate anything, including evangelism, that smacks of religious intolerance? And I say, well, one of the ways is through music and through the stories and the poetry of these hymn writers who aren't necessarily preaching, but inviting people to say, try this on. Now, of course, there's certainly a lot of hymns that are preachy. It's interesting, a lot of the real polemic preachy hymns have fallen out of use. Watts wrote some really horrible ones that would just make Calvinists cringe, all the worst kind of stereotypes. And Wesley wrote some really horrible ones, too, that make Arminians cringe. But a lot of those kind of have dropped out of use, fortunately. Though they're fun to read about, and probably some of you guys in your classes sort of introduce people to those sometimes. But again, you know, this theology, this theological poetry that we have in the hymns, I find for people that think they really don't care about doctrine and poetry, this actually grabs them. So let me read you a testimony of a student. Now, the reason I love this testimony is because she didn't write this to me. This is a girl named Lori. She got on this website, Relevant.com. Any of you guys familiar with Relevant magazine? I know you love that title. It's actually a very good magazine, Relevant magazine. They just started coming out with a print issue, I think, even this month. But they had an article in there about old hymns. And she read it, and then you had a bulletin board where you could post comments, which is a very good thing to do, actually, if you're reaching younger people. They love to interact and not just be preached at. But she said this, you know, right on, I'm a member of Christ Community Church in Nashville, Tennessee, as well as a member of RUF at Belmont University. Now, this is a girl that we met helping college student freshmen move into their dorm. My wife met her, and my wife is so much better at meeting people and being outgoing and all that kind of stuff. So she met this girl. The girl decided, based on that meeting and liking my wife, to come to RUF. And here's what she says: coming from a typical praise chorus reliant high school youth group, I sort of turned my nose up as I was handed a notebook of hymns at my first visit to RUF. We sing basically all hymns in our group, okay? I didn't understand a lot of the poetic and imagery-driven lyrics, and the word hymn automatically meant boring music. But as the weeks passed, I found myself falling in love with the old hymns and the idea of putting new and very beautiful music to them. The words are so profound and full of truth, one can't help but be broken. Singing hymns has seriously changed my life and freed me from feeling frustrated by surface lyrics that focus on how I feel about God, which is always changing. It's this, you know, great thing in 1 John where he says, and so we know and rely on the love God has for us. That's the NIV translation, which is a complete paradigm shift for most Christians. They are relying on their love for God rather than God's love for them. The problem with that, of course, like God says through Hosea, your love, O Ephraim, is like the morning mist. The morning mist, as soon as the sun comes up, it's gone. So if you're relying on your love for God, you're in a lot of trouble. That's why Augustus Toplady says, could my zeal no respite know? Could my tears forever flow? All for sin could not atone. Thou must save, and thou alone. He's saying the same thing. So she's beginning to come alive to this because she's actually understanding, oh, if all I ever sing is, Lord, I just want to praise you, that's actually not true. And no matter how many times I sing it, it's not going to become true. The words are so profound and full of truth, one can't help but be broken. Singing hymns has seriously changed my life, freed me from feeling frustrated by surface lyrics that focus on how I feel about God, which is always changing. Hymns have allowed me to center my worship on the gospel, which in turn compels me to love the God I'm prone to hate and wander from. So even how the language of the hymns has even begin to enter into the way she expresses her faith. Isn't that awesome? And all, I must check out in Double Grace. Anyway, then she talks about in Double Grace, and I'll spare you that. But I just found that fascinating. That she's actually being discipled by Robert Robertson, who wrote Come Thou Fount. Her understanding of the Christian life and the ups and downs of the Christian life is becoming so much bigger and so much more biblical. And now she actually has categories to understand the ups and downs that she experiences and realizes that she's not alone. One of the great things I think a lot of people suffer from in the church is feeling like I really hate God right now and I'm the only one, because nobody ever gets up front publicly and says that. But if we sing hymns like Dear Refuge of My Weary Soul, people say, oh, man, not only, you know, this lady thought that, and it actually made it into the hymn book, you know, wow, that's how I feel. You know, maybe I'm not crazy after all. So again, it's a great reason to read spiritual autobiographies too. Because most Christians feel like they're crazy because they find such warfare in their heart. And they've been told that if they trust Jesus, that everything will be great. And I love Robert Murray McShane, one of my great mentors, 19th century Scottish guy, and a hymn writer, actually, too, besides being a Presbyterian pastor. He said, a Christian is known as much by his warfare as he is by his peace. And yet, see, a lot of the modern praise choruses, you'll never get that. You'll never get that idea. And I think that's a shame, because I think there are a lot of people who are laboring under the idea that they're not, maybe not even Christians, or if they are, that they're not very mature Christians. John Newton, the great hymn writer, has these three little letters. I definitely commend to your reading the letters of John Newton. But he has three letters on sort of a baby Christian, a growing Christian, and a mature Christian. And he says the baby Christian is one who lives on his frames. You're familiar with that phrase probably from The Solid Rock. You may not know what it means, where it says, I dare not trust the sweetest frame, but wholly lean on Jesus' name. A sweet frame is a sweet emotional state. And he said an immature Christian is one who lives basically on their mountaintop experiences and on those emotional states. And a mature Christian is one who basically is struggling and wrestling and fighting. Now, here's the interesting thing. Most college students that I minister to are trying to get back to a mountaintop experience they had at junior high camp. And they think that they're immature if they can't get back there. But see, John Newton says just the opposite. So it's very interesting. You know, the hymn writers, I'm telling you, these guys, so many of these men and women had such a better handle on the mature Christian faith and what it felt like. And we really, raised on a diet of 10 steps into how to have a happy devotional life, we really need that wisdom. And we really need that wisdom if we want to reach a younger generation who craves authenticity. Because they know that everything is not just happy for Christians. Because they may have been raised in families where their parents tried to tell them that that's, Jesus makes everything okay and everything happy. But they've known that that's not true. Anyway, the challenge, the last thing here on this outline, the challenge is to provide roots and wings, Gerard Kelly says, to bring young people into a sense of connectedness with the past that doesn't rob them of their vision of the future. And unfortunately, we've tended to polarize this whole debate into either you like tradition or you like contemporary. And I love the way he says we want to provide roots and wings, that both of those things are important. That it's not a good idea, for instance, to only tell young people that they need to just submit to their elders and do what we've always done. Because almost every significant innovation and movement in church music has been through young people. I was just reading some of Top Lady's hymns. And, most of his hymns he wrote between 15 and 18 years of age. Isaac Watts, how old was he when he, first started writing hymns? You guys know, 20, 21? Young, more? Older? Pretty young, though. He wasn't like a 50-year-old guy. He was kind of a young whippersnapper, the story goes, who said to his dad, who was one of the deacons, I don't like this music. And he said, well, go write something better. And he went home that afternoon and worked on something, brought it back, and they sang it that night. It's just very interesting. And the youth really do have some enthusiasm that we need not to squelch. But it's helpful to channel it somewhat. In other words, if I boil this thought down, it's this. Fathers, don't exasperate your children, Paul says. I think there's an application to church music. And the idea about respecting your elders, I think there's an application to church music with that as well. Marva Dawn has a very helpful way of saying this thing. She says, if the body of Christ really reflects the body of Christ and not just our peer group, then everybody needs to sing songs they don't like. And I think we can challenge old and young alike to say that, it's not just about me and what I like. Because, basically everybody thinks that the ultimate worship is whatever they were experiencing when Christ really came alive to them. And if it was high church or if it was singing around a campfire, kumbaya, you'll forever kind of associate that with the ultimate in worship, but pretty much. But it's just, it's not necessarily about that. It's about the body of Christ is bigger than even any one person's aesthetic sense. Anyway, for what it's worth, turn to this other little page. Community, passion, community, and story. I think I've said some about passion. This is, which one? The blue? Are we back to that blue page on why we need hymns in a postmodern world? Yeah, why we need hymns in a postmodern world. I kind of talked about a few of these ideas, but now we're sort of on to page, the backside of this thing. And if you weren't here for last hour lecture, it's going to be on the website. You can get the tape. But you can also pretty much read through this because it's pretty complete and probably says it better than I managed to say it a few minutes ago. I talked here about hymns tell a story. This is point two on the back side of this blue page. So turn the blue page over. Hymns tell a story and walk us through the gospel. Modern choruses, again, I think there are modern choruses being written that are well done. So, you know, take that as a qualification or sort of, you know. But I really want to say that there are some things that hymns do really well that we could benefit from and continue to learn from and still need. And I think the postmodern world makes some of these needs even more acute or at least more present in people in their own understanding. So modern choruses are often more like images that flash on the television screen for a moment. They may be really powerful images and they may be really helpful images. But I think there's a real value to sort of sitting in a truth for a few minutes and looking at it from different angles, like hymns tend to do, and sort of taking it through a story. Like, for instance, my wife would say that one of her fondest memories in church is standing next to her grandmother singing, and when they would sing a hymn, and especially get to that last verse about heaven, and invariably she'd look over to grandmother and see tears rolling down her cheek. Now, that changes you. And it sort of brings you into something that, oh, okay, I'm a 7-year-old little girl, 8-year-old little girl. I don't know why she's crying, but something's going on here. And I want to be part of that. So there's a sense in which these hymns walk us through a story. And again, a skillful worship leader today can sort of put together praise courses in a way to simulate that. And I think, that's good. One of the hard things, though, if you only stick to praise choruses, is you'll be pretty limited in the kinds of emotions that you can sort of get to. The hymns tend to cover a wider emotional range and tend to, I think, actually have more passion. I mean, the praise choruses talk about, I want it, I want it, I want it, I want it. I don't know, here's maybe a helpful illustration. Again, I got from Tim Keller. The difference between good writing and bad writing, like in a novel. Bad writing describes the heroine this way. It says, she was beautiful. And good writing describes her in such a way that when you read the description, you say, she's beautiful. Do you see the difference? The one, you basically just tell people what they're supposed to feel. In the other, you describe somebody in a way that you can't help but draw the reader into feeling that feeling. And I think the hymns do a better job of describing Jesus and the gospel. So many of them are not actually prayers directly to God. And in that regard, the modern praise chorus movement has sort of redirected us to say, hey, don't just sing to each other. Sing to God directly. That's important. And there are certainly hymns that do that. But a lot of the hymns are kind of exhortations to the body. Okay? Let's believe this stuff that's in the Bible. Okay? We're singing it to each other to believe it. But describing it in such a way that we're captured by the beauty of it. Rather than just saying, Jesus is beautiful, Jesus is beautiful. Describing in such a way that we go, oh, he's beautiful. So the emotional range of emotional range of expression is really important. And I think it's really important for worshipers in all days and ages. And it always encourages me to see Calvin, for instance, in his commentary on the Psalms in the preface, which you should definitely read. Even if you never read his commentary on the Psalms, you should at least read the preface. He describes the Psalter as an anatomy of the soul. This is Calvin, who this sort of blows people away, who have a stereotypical idea of Calvin different than he really was. But he says that sometimes, actually, the Psalms kind of help us discover that we're feeling something we didn't even know we were feeling until we sing it and we read it. And I think that that's really helpful, that we come to worship not just so that we can tell God everything that we feel, but sometimes we come to be searched by Him and find out that we felt things we didn't even know we were bringing into worship. Anyway, the hymns, I think, also remind us that church is bigger than the people we know or even the people who are alive today. And this is this idea about story and community. One of the things I found really interesting when we had our worship conference down in Nashville back in the fall was how many hymn writers, particularly in previous generations, were actually involved in pastoral ministry or were writing for a particular community. They weren't just sort of holed up. Like, you know, today a lot of songwriters in Nashville who churn out this gospel music, you know, they're writing to get cuts on records. You know, they're getting together to, like, let's sit down and write today so that we can get a cut on a record. It's not born out of actually ministering to a real community. Now, again, there's great exceptions, and I'm glad for that. But you know, that's really the exception when you look at the hymn writers. So many of them are writing to minister to a particular flock, and then the reason that we sing those hymns is because they resonated with people and they've gotten a wider hearing. But generally they were kind of tried out first or used even in an actual community. And so it's very interesting. You think about William Cooper and John Newton, who wrote the Olney hymns. And if you read the preface, and that's the hymn book that, like, Amazing Grace and Oh for a Closer Walk with Thee, There's a Fountain Full of Blood, all these wonderful hymns come out of this collection. And the preface, John Newton says that really the hymn book was to be a testimony to their friendship. It wasn't just about writing hymns. It was to be a testimony to this friendship that God had created between the two of them. And when William Cooper went insane, Newton said he was so discouraged and depressed, he almost didn't finish the collection. And for years, you know, wondered if he would even publish it. And then he decided to go ahead and publish it. But it's interesting. You find a lot of that kind of stuff. You find people who are actually writing. Anyway, like Charles Wesley, you know, there's stories of how he would hear about a particular little group of Methodists who'd been stoned or, you know, attacked by a mob, and he'd write a hymn and send it to them so that they could sing it at their church service the next week. And the way these people, you know, Charlie Peacock had this great idea. He's an elder at our church and a Christian musician, songwriter, all that kind of stuff. He said, you know, get the people in your faith community to tell their stories to the artists so that the artists can help the whole community celebrate those stories through song or through art or through all these kinds of things. And I think that's a wonderful idea. Because, again, a lot of people in our sort of post-literate age communicate more by story and symbol. And actually, in a lot of ways, they've always done that. We're just recognizing it more. We think that people really kind of grab onto just propositional truth, but there's a lot of, you know, myth and story that's really what they're grabbing onto. Anyway, I think that's a wonderful idea. So that the stories that are going on in your community can be used, can be celebrated. The music that we're doing, for instance, generally are you know, I give off these hymn books to these guys, these students, and they read through them and they go, oh, this really speaks to me. I want us to be able to sing this, and I want to give testimony of how the Lord used this text to change me. And Chip sent me this wonderful email about, you know, this particular text, and he goes, this text has changed me. Have we had that experience? And if so, we want to sing those songs and share them with others. So you know, worship, singing is always this kind of community experience. I'll give you this great story from William Willimon, who writes in a book, Resident Aliens. You guys read this book, Resident Aliens? Fascinating book. And he has a sequel to that called Where Resident Aliens Live. And William Willimon is the chaplain at Duke over in North Carolina. And he tells this story about meeting with a group of Lutheran students at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday evening and to celebrate the Eucharist. And he sits down and he talks to them and says, you know, when you were back in Des Moines, you probably thought that Lutherans ran things, you know, with a full parking lot and, you know, just, you know, everybody in town was a Lutheran. And it felt like, you know, Lutherans ran the world. But now you come here to Duke University and you find out that we're out to kill Lutherans. But don't take it, you know, don't take it personally. We treat Jews and Catholics the same way. He says, basically, the university is out to make you a lot less Christian, a lot less Lutheran than you were when you got here. And so you found, And he's addressing these Lutherans. He said, if you want to survive as Lutherans, that you need to get together, sing Lutheran songs, eat Lutheran food, tell Lutheran stories. But what he's articulating there is the formative power of worship. And sort of, for me, giving me a vision about what we're actually doing when we gather together in Christian worship. I had sort of a funny story. When I was in seminary, one of my professors was a Norwegian and found out I was half Norwegian. So he invited me to go to the Sons of Norway meeting. Has anybody been to the Sons of Norway meeting? Well, let me tell you what they do at a Sons of Norway meeting. It's, you know, about 50 people gathered together. Most of them were considerably older than me. And they first have this huge, like, Norwegian buffet. You thought the Swedish, you know, buffet was the thing, but the Norwegians can really hold their own when it comes to a buffet. And you eat all this weird Norwegian food. Some of it's really good, like lefse, which is like this flat potato pancake that you put butter and sugar in it and roll it up and eat it. It's wonderful. But some of it is like lutefisk. And lutefisk is basically a cod that they take and they soak it in lye for a couple weeks until it starts to rot, and then they cook it. And let me tell you, if you eat lutefisk, you're being shaped as a Norwegian. You have an identity that's being confirmed, right? And then somebody gives a Norwegian lesson. You learn how to say some Norwegian words, and then you sing some Norwegian songs, and then we watched a movie about some Norwegian heroes. And you probably didn't know there were Norwegian heroes. I didn't. But it seems that in the Second World War, there were these four Norwegian guys. Here's the story. Basically, Hitler had this plant where he was developing heavy water to make a hydrogen bomb. I think it was in Finland. And he made some heavy water and was transporting it across this body of water. I don't remember if it was a lake or a sea or what it was. But these four Norwegian guys, like cross-country skied across the whole country, somehow got on that boat and sank it and prevented Hitler from getting the bomb. And if they hadn't done that, the whole course of world history might be different. So they tell the stories about those guys. Now, see, now, what a parallel for what we're doing in worship. Instead of sort of trying to become like the world so that the world will sort of walk in the door, how about saying, look, to come into this world over here changes everything. It changes the way you think. It changes the way you feel. If the gospel is true, it turns everything upside down. And you know, the things we sing, the things that we say, even the words, again, you don't just use those words. You have a lesson. You know, here's what this word means. We use this in Christian terminology. We think it's an important word because it's not that it's magical, but we think it's helpful because words really do matter. And so we sing these songs because they encapsulate truths that we think are really important to hold on to. I've been more and more attracted to that vision of what worship should be about, or at least incorporating some of those ideas. There was an issue of Leadership Magazine a few years ago interviewing a bunch of 20-something worship leaders about the whole issue of what is seeker-sensitive worship. And they said, basically, you know, all these happy praise choruses, you know, are repugnant to our generation. We want songs about suffering and death. And, you know, we got lots of songs about suffering and death. Some wonderful, wonderful songs, wonderful hymns. I tell people, like, you know, go get Gadsby's hymns. This is 1,200 Reformed Baptist hymns, most of which you've never heard. So many powerful hymns that need to be sung and can really have power to change us and shape us. The one Chip was talking about was out of this collection. I don't know. How much time we got here? Do we got time for a few questions? All right, let's have a few questions. I feel like I've been talking forever, but we got a little longer than this one, right? Good. Okay. Yes. Oh, I went to Covenant Theological Seminary in St. Louis. Oh, yeah. Question. Biography. Where did I go to seminary? Covenant Theological Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri. Yes. Yes. What's the name of this collection I refer to? I actually have quite a few things I'll refer you to, but Gadsby's Hymns. Gadsby, who did this one? William Gadsby. English, particular Baptist. This collection is huge and completely unorganized. But, it really is. But here's a great thing. I just found this. It's actually out on CD-ROM. Now, the people that sell this aren't the best organized. So, like, I've given out their website to some people, and they've had a hard time getting them to respond. But I'll give Chip the info when I get back home because I didn't bring it with me. But you can search by words with this. So I like the other day, looked up the word sweetness. So, you know, because there's no, like this isn't organized by themes at all. It's just a mass collection of hymns. And so you can just read. I have students that just kind of read through a couple of these every day as part of their devotions. And when they find one that resonates with them, they mark it. And then next time they're feeling like they want to sit down and write a song or something, they go back to some of these texts that have resonated with them. But this is really helpful. Another one I'd recommend, certainly, and maybe even probably before Gadsby, I'd recommend Spurgeon's hymnal, our own hymn book. This has been reprinted after years of being out of print. And you can get it from pilgrimpub.org for $14. And it has lots of cool hymns in here. 1,053 hymns. No music, just hymns. Spurgeon. If you go on that website, you find it. It's called Our Own Hymn Book. But if you do, it's just Spurgeon's hymn book. If you go to pilgrimpub.org, or do they have them in the bookstore? Not yet. We're working on it. This is wonderful. And this is organized by theme. And he has a lot of obscure. I find he has a lot of obscure hymns in here. He was a real bibliophile, had this massive library. And he seems to have like found hymns that you don't find a lot of other collections too. So I give these out. If you want to try and you know, stir this kind of movement up in your church or with your young people, I give these things all the time to musicians and to songwriters, just kind of seeing what they'll do with it. I give them out to other people too because they're wonderful devotional books. Anyway, is that helpful? Yeah. Did you have a question? No. Yeah. Okay. Why don't we use piano? What's wrong with piano? Nothing except they're hard to move, and the room we meet in doesn't have a piano. And the two CDs that we did, we didn't have studios that had pianos. But I'll tell you, the new one we're working on now, there's a lot of piano. Because we rented out a studio that had a real Hammond B3, a real Wurlitzer, and a real acoustic piano. So it has a lot more piano on it. So it's mostly just that. Like most of these CDs we did, and most of the REF groups, we don't have piano. We just have guitar players. Typical, you know, kind of college ministry meeting. So, but I love piano. So nothing against it. And yeah, he plays piano. And we're working on piano music as well. But I will definitely encourage. Do you play jazz piano at all? It's worth getting some jazz piano lessons. I always try to encourage people to do that, especially if you're still young enough that you can learn some new tricks. Because unfortunately, I don't know what it's like here. So. But I'll just say in a general way, a lot of church music programs train people in piano in such a way that they're dependent upon every note being written for them or they're helpless. And that's tragic. Because if you can learn that, you know, this little dot in this little place means I play this, you can learn C minor 7 means I play this. Right? They're just different notation systems. So encouraging that sort of thing. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah. Oh, yeah. 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 Experience. Do I have any experience working with youth and the hymns? Well, starting with my 2.5-year-old, he could sing a bunch of these hymns as a 2-year-old, 2.5-year-old. And I have a lot of testimonies from those that people write me emails or fellow friends of mine say, my kids know all the words to these hymns, so, which definitely challenges the kind of song, to me, sort of the popular idea about what kind of songs we need to sing to our children. Charles Spurgeon, was his grandmother that gave him a penny for every hymn that he memorized as a young boy, and he said that had a huge effect on his theology. Of course, he had a photographic memory, which helped, and he, you know, found he could memorize lots of hymns and get money that way. But I definitely think it's great to the young, and this music definitely has resonated with high school students, junior high students. A lot of it is just, you know, being willing to say, I know, you know, the Christian music industry markets this is what college students like and high school students like. But if you just try something else, and particularly if you do things like tell the story behind a hymn, like I would say, you know, if you're in a group that's only doing like praise and worship chorus music, you kind of have to draw people into this gradually. And you can do it by saying, here's a CD, you can listen to this music. And I'm fine. It's interesting. Like this raises for me a whole new way of thinking about how people learn music. Because now we have people, they don't necessarily just learn the song when we do it the first time in a worship service. They've heard the CDs, and they already know the music. So that's kind of interesting to think about the impact that'll have in the future of church music. Maybe people don't read music as much anymore, but you could even make a CD as a church maybe more easily 5-10 years from now when you guys are more, you know, doing this kind of thing, and people could learn the music before you ever do it at church. I don't know. It's kind of a crazy idea because we've never done it. We don't really do it that way, but I'm seeing it happen because we go around the country where we've never played, but people know this music just through the CDs and can already join in, which is cool. So you can play the CDs, but then I would say introduce one song and try to, you know, for one, at least one hymn to either tell the story behind it or to sort of point out one verse, something about that, to really connect people to what they're singing. And Chip and I were talking about this a little bit. I mean, what you see a lot of times is two extremes. The church I grew up in, for instance, we did 5 or 6 new hymns every week. And it just sort of like was like, you know, this fire hydrant just gushing, you know, just blowing you away. But then a lot of churches, you know, might sing 5 hymns or all that they ever sing. Every once in a while they throw in a hymn, but it's basically 5 of them that they do. And, you know, we probably have a canon of about 40 or 50 that we'll do in a year or two. And to the point where students actually really can memorize those things and they really start to impact even the way they express their faith. And I think really enrich their understanding of their faith and expression. And I've seen that happen with high school students, particularly if the college students are the ones leading worship, then they're more into, oh, maybe this is cool after all. So I think you just have to try it. I haven't really found, I mean, one of the things that's really cool, when we did a concert down in Orlando this past year, somebody had told the senior citizens group of the church to come to this concert and the youth group, the high school youth group. And it was great to see, you know, the kids up there, you know, dancing, and then, and the, you know, some of the senior citizens afterwards kind of said, hey, come here, we want to talk to you. And I was like, uh-oh. Said, we just love what you're doing, you know. So it's been interesting, sometimes unexpected, you know, people that really say, man, this is wonderful. So, and again, you know, get those high school students writing songs. Because a lot of them play music. And to understand the way music functions for them, for community building, for helping them articulate things that are confusing them and, you know, some of their ragings that go on, to be able to, again, sort of try and direct them towards, you know, worship music. Find some hymns here, you know, that, for instance, that seem to connect with things you're saying.